Well, good evening. It's Wednesday, the 2nd of October. I'm Alec Hogg from BizNews. In this episode of the BizNews Briefing, we're going to have a look at Tshwane again, but this time through the eyes of South Africa's greatest political analyst, the former Oxford Don, R.W. Johnson. We'll also be picking up on things in the Middle East. Mr. Johnson's got some thoughts on that too, and we'll hear there from our partners at the FT and Bloomberg. And then there's markets. David Bacher from Corian giving us his thoughts about what October might be like after a stonking September where South African shares outperformed the rest of the world. We'll also hear from the Chief Investment Officer of Ford Asset Management. So there's a lot coming up in the next half hour, but let's kick off with R.W. Johnson. He is the favorite analyst of the BizNews community. When he writes, well, we tend to see that the premium subscriptions go higher. So we love R.W. Johnson. Our community loves him, and long may he continue to give us his unique insights into what's happening in the South African political scene. He applied his mind today to the goings-on in Tshwane, and let's listen in.
The way that Action SA has behaved is peculiar, and I'm still waiting to see what someone like Athol Trollip would say about this, because he's a very sensible, intelligent man, and he's been very careful in what he says. And I haven't noticed him say anything at all about this, which probably means that he doesn't agree, but I don't know, I'm guessing. Look, I think that Action SA has got itself in a peculiar situation. They've thrown over the DA. They then announce that they're going to provide the next mayor. The ANC immediately says, no, you're not, and denies that they have an agreement to that regard. I mean, it doesn't look to me like they're very much in charge of events. And I don't know what's going to happen ultimately there. But it does seem to me that Zilla has played a very strong card by saying, look, we want to continue with talks to stabilize the metros if you're going to play the game this way. If you want to stabilize the metros, well, you can start with Tshwane. We had a very good mayor in place and putting things to right, and you're now getting rid of it. I mean, what on earth is going on? And, of course, the problem is partly that the Gauteng ANC is obviously a law unto itself.
And how do you think that is going to play out, given the ANC in Gauteng does appear to be flexing its muscles against the national grouping?
Well, it really does depend on whether Ramaphosa will impose his authority, because we all know that although Panyaza Lesufi is a very determined populist, that ultimately the person who is the most influential in controlling the behavior of the Gauteng ANC is Paul Mashatile. So the deputy president is playing a different game than the president. And frankly, the president needs to assert himself.
Well, we'll hear more from R.W. Johnson later in the program when we apply our minds to what's going on in the Middle East. What is interesting, though, today we had the release of the first survey of South African voters post the formation of the Government of National Unity. It came from Franz Kronier's Social Research Foundation, and it found that both the ANC and the DA's popularity was up 10 percentage points. The finding was that 60% of South Africans think the Government of National Unity is doing just great. 28% felt it wasn't. The rest, of course, undecided. But interestingly enough, the EFF came out in those polls with a share of the vote, if the election were held today, of just 6%. Over at the Institute for Race Relations, they are having a look at what's going on in the metros. And today, my colleague Chris Steyn spoke with Marius Ruert to get the insight on what the research they're doing and ideas that are coming out there could have for the rest of us.
Yeah, we're still workshopping some ideas around, but it basically comes down to stabilizing coalitions. So there's quite a few things you can do. I mean, as you know, in South Africa, there's a very short time to form a coalition after an election. There's only 2 weeks. And in other countries, they take much longer. I mean, there's always the example of Belgium that's spoken about, where it took 500 days for a new government to be formed. Even in Germany, I think it took 2 months for their last coalition to be formed. So I think in South Africa, we need to look at extending the period that's allowed for coalitions to be formed. 2 weeks, I mean, it's pretty much a miracle that we managed to get a GNU formed in the 2 weeks that we did have, especially in a place like South Africa with such with parties with such different views and outlooks and so on. So there's definitely something that I think we need to look at extending the time that allows for government to be formed. I think maybe a satisfactory period would be maybe something like 2 months or 60 days or something. It would also probably be useful to make coalition agreements publicly available to people to see what they say and what the kind of method to enforce consensus and so on would be. There's also maybe we should look at forming something like a coalition ombudsman and have an office of an ombudsman where when parties are disagreeing that are in coalitions, they can go to mediation and so on. And we should also maybe look at having some form of binding agreements. This is maybe a bit more tricky because obviously if you go vote for a mayor and then turns out that he's actually, you know, a massive fraudster or he killed a puppy or something, you know, you don't want to be stuck in a binding agreement with somebody like that. So there'd have to be some ways that you could escape a binding agreement, but I think those would be also quite useful. And I don't think a binding agreement for the full term of, you know, the legislature would be a good idea, but something maybe for, say, 2 years or something, or, you know, we could take it on a case-by-case basis. So there's different ways that I think we do need to stabilize municipalities. Another something else we can look at is deciding how much responsibility a municipality should have. We do know that lots of municipalities in South Africa, especially rural municipalities, suffer from lack of resources and a lack of expertise.
Isn't that just the truth? Well, it does appear as though there is hope on the horizon. I'm not so sure what people in the Middle East are feeling about that topic, because while we were on air last night, and just to remind you, the BizNews briefing hits the audio-only airwaves, in other words, on BizNews Radio, which is on Spotify and iTunes at 5 o'clock every day, and then on our BizNews TV channel on YouTube at 6 o'clock every day. So please set yourself a date. If you like to listen, then it's at 5. If you like to watch, then it's at 6. Well, while we were going out last night, there was incredible ructions going on in the Middle East. I had a few people suggesting to me that World War III had begun. Well, it hasn't, and it doesn't mean to downplay what happened last night or indeed what might happen next. We need to understand that geopolitics is playing an ever-increasing role in our lives. And indeed, the Bank of England today released details of a survey that it had done in the financial services sector in the UK, and there 93% came back with the feeling that geopolitics was the one thing that could put the whole sector in a different trajectory. That's their biggest concern. 93%, it's an all-time record high. Not surprisingly, what's happening. So let's start off with our coverage of what's going on in the Middle East with our partners at Bloomberg.
Israel has vowed to retaliate after Iran attacked the country with ballistic missiles in a sharp escalation of conflict in the region. The strike involved around 200 missiles, which Israel said it mostly intercepted, with one person reportedly killed in the West Bank. Israel's Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu says they will fight back.
Iran made a major mistake and it will pay for it. The regime in Iran just doesn't understand our determination to defend ourselves and our determination to retaliate to our enemies.
That's Benjamin Netanyahu speaking through a translator. The Iranian reprisal follows the decision by Israel to send ground forces across the border into Lebanon and the killing of Hezbollah leader Hassan Nasrallah in a Beirut airstrike last week. The European Union said in a statement that successive waves of attacks and retaliations have been fueling an uncontrollable spiral of conflict. Iran's foreign minister spoke to his French, British and German counterparts in separate phone calls, warning, quote, any third party against intervening in this conflict.
The latest Iranian strike came with minimal warning, which was in contrast to April's attack, which was telegraphed well in advance and involved slower-moving missiles and drones. Tehran's decision to launch another direct attack on Israel has raised the prospect of more tit-for-tat reprisals. The UK Prime Minister Keir Starmer says he is deeply concerned.
I utterly condemn this attempt by the Iranian regime to harm innocent Israelis, to escalate this incredibly dangerous situation and push the region ever closer to the brink.
Starmer's comments come after the Ministry of Defence confirmed that British military forces had been involved in the efforts to counter the strike from Iran. We're also getting reports that Hezbollah says its forces have clashed with Israeli soldiers in a village in the south of Lebanon. The confrontation marks the latest escalation of Israel's months-long campaign against the Iran-backed militant group and will further add to concerns from Western and Arab nations over a wider Middle East conflict.
There's a superb piece on BizNews Premium today on how the Israelis managed to not be hit by any of those 180 missiles, from long-range ballistic missiles and all kinds of modern equipment that went through there. I really strongly recommend that you go and read that. If you're not a Premium member, well, here's a very good excuse to become one. Talking about our partners at the Financial Times, Sonia Hudson, who is the anchor of the FT News Briefing, spoke to James Pelidi, and here's the report that they put together on what has been happening in Israel, the Middle East, Iran over the last 24 hours.
This is all something the U.S. desperately wanted to avoid, says the FT's Washington bureau chief James Pelidi.
Ever since the October 7th attacks by Hamas against Israel, the U.S. has tried to limit really the conflict to Israel and Palestine. And that objective has really fallen apart in the last few weeks because the threat posed by Iran to Israel have really flared up. And the fact that Israel has kind of expanded the scope of its own attacks on Iran and its proxies, this is not what the U.S. wanted to see happen, but it's actually happening now.
The U.S. has tried repeatedly over the past year to broker a ceasefire, first in Gaza and more recently in Lebanon. But now, James says that the situation in the Middle East is deteriorating almost in defiance of Washington's efforts, and that could have lasting consequences.
I think it's going to, you know, raise quite a lot of questions about U.S. influence internationally and in the Middle East specifically, that those calls have kind of fallen on deaf ears. And I think that that's being, you know, watched very closely around the world. Of course, this is a very rapidly moving situation. What happens in the next few days and next few hours will be really important. We'll have to see whether the U.S. manages to achieve some measure of deterrence and containment from this point on.
He says Washington finds that its influence is being put to the test again in light of the new attacks.
At the moment, U.S. officials are saying that Iran would face severe consequences for attacking Israel. That attack has now occurred. The discussion in Washington has shifted to, well, to what extent is the U.S. going to back Israel's response to the Iranian attack, and what the fallout will be from that. So we're pretty far from a scenario of a rapid de-escalation.
R.W. Johnson spent 26 years at Oxford University. You may recall he was an anti-apartheid campaigner, was a Rhodes Scholar winner, won a Rhodes Scholarship, went to Oxford University and taught political science for more than two decades, before returning to South Africa in 1994, when democracy arrived in this country. So he has a very good feeling for international affairs, and I asked him about the concerns that many have that what we're seeing now could evolve into World War III. Here's his thoughts.
The more that Israel gets involved in a fight with Iran, the more it needs American support. And I don't think Netanyahu will is in a very strong position to keep pushing there. If Biden says, we won't back you, then he's got to back them, because Iran is a very serious opponent. So I think the Americans do have the ability to calm that to some degree. So I expect the Israelis to launch some sort of retaliation, but I don't know how serious it will be. And I think the Americans will then again want them to stop and leave it at that. Which, after all, the main objective of the Israelis is, having dealt with Hamas, to now deal with Hezbollah and to make their own people safe and secure and able to return to their home. They don't have to have a fight with Iran.
But isn't it inevitable that at some point in time, Israel and Iran, given how much they dislike each other, or the leadership at the moment anyway, will come to serious blows?
Well, yes and no. Look, you're talking about a nuclear war. The Israelis have certainly got nuclear weapons, and the Iranians are very close to getting. Now, as we can see with India and Pakistan, when both sides have got nuclear weapons, it's also a good reason not to start anything. And so I don't know that that's really true. I think that the hostility between them is not going to go away, or at least not while that Iranian regime is there. But I think, look, the other point is this, is that what I think really triggered Hamas on October the 7th and quite likely Iran behind them was this whole determination led by the Americans to launch a sort of land bridge between India and the Middle East. There's a large Indian expatriate population in the Middle East, and India has a very strong sort of economic reason for further involvement there. And that land bridge, Israel was going to play a crucial part in, and of course it would be very important for the Saudis and the UAE and so forth. And it would inevitably involve recognition of Israel by the Saudis, which was the key to the whole thing. Now, I think that was very much on the point of happening, and that Hamas and Iran wanted to stop that at all costs. I think that the game was beginning to run away from them. So the real question is, once we have got some sort of peace again, however strained and difficult, whether or not that can be resurrected, there will be powerful forces wanting to do so.
Isn't it wonderful to have someone like R.W. Johnson to guide us through what's going on? I urge you to watch the full interview. In it, he also takes a look at the chaos that John Steenhuisen, the leader of the Democratic Alliance, has wrought on the Department of Agriculture, and how this contrasts with his colleagues, his DA colleagues who are in the cabinet. And then we look ahead to, well, perhaps the DA will be looking for a different leader come their next elections. RW says that the person who's being most promoted in that regard is the current mayor of Cape Town. His thought is, too soon for you, Jordan Hill Lewis. There's also more on the Israeli-Iran conflict, and indeed how the Israelis planned what has happened over the past few days for many, many years, right down to the type of aeroplanes that it purchased from the United States, a very old and in many respects not the kind of fighter jets that or bombers that the U.S. was expecting to sell, but they were particularly purchased for the mission that they had against Nasrallah, the head of Hezbollah in Lebanon. And RW suggests that they might also have nuclear facilities in Iran as part of the next target. Man, the stuff that's happening on the international scene, the geopolitics, it means a heck of a lot to what is going to happen here in South Africa. But we had a great September. What's going to happen in October? I asked David Bacher this question. He is the Chief Investment Officer of Corient Capital.
It's definitely going to be a month of volatility And I think what's happening in the Middle East is going to be the big decider of asset class returns. No one likes volatility. No one likes war. No one likes uncertainty, especially investors. So it's very hard to see things out for the month because of these events. I think our investment premise is always based on the longer term at Corian. We still think South African assets are cheap. We still are concerned about America in terms of its valuations. And we still think China, given, even though it was up 25%, given how it has underperformed for a decade by so much, we think that's still got runway. So we, in short, underweight the US and largely overweight everywhere else, and think you can find value in the world elsewhere.
And in South Africa in particular?
I think, the markets have been up about 30% over the last few months. That's a significant rally. But you're still having shares, banking shares, that are giving you dividend yields of 7-8%. Historically, that is extremely cheap. So we'll be favoring financials and insurance companies, and also some SA Inc. sensitive stocks. Although it has rallied hard and a lot over the last 12 months, you've got to take a look going forward. These companies, we believe, are still priced at attractive valuations, and we believe they got runway.
So it's almost as though they'd gone so far down, now that they're lifting their heads off the troughs, doesn't mean that it's over. It could just be the start.
Correct. You never want to buy too early and then wait for this moment, which we've been waiting at Corian, and then trim, just in the first lap. And we think it is the first lap of potentially many more laps. We are positively positioned for South African assets. So, our hope is that the party has started, but it's still going to be lots to enjoy, and we're not leaving the party too soon.
David has been calling the South African upswing on the equity market very, very well indeed. And he was also early to the party in China, which had a phenomenal month of September, up by 25% Chinese stocks. There was a knock-on effect on South African shares, in particular Naspers and Prosus, and their run continues. Prosus got to a new 12-month high today of 787 rands a share, up another 3.75%. Naspers, its stable mate, was up by 3.6%. Naspers at 4,389 rand a share. As far as the market as a whole is concerned, well, it was a green day, pretty much. All share index just under 1% better. Financials were the least in favor, but even they were up about 0.33%. Industrials around 1%, and same for resources. The Rand, 17 Rand 40, so a little bit weaker, and that's not surprising given what's going on in the Middle East. There is clearly some risk now, and you find in situations like this that investors around the world tend to take their money away from emerging markets and developing countries, or what they call risk-related assets, and put them into risk-off assets, and that means the US dollar, which is the reserve currency in the world. Anywhere you go in the world, if you have US dollars, people will accept it. We're closing off today's program with a little clip from an interview with a guy who's pretty low profile but very high performer. His name's Nick Belkin, and he's the Chief Investment Officer at Ford Asset Management. Now, I recall Ford when Dave Ford and Liston Mankies launched it 40 years ago, and it was a very small investment house, which has become a huge operation today, handling hundreds of billions of rands, literally, in assets on behalf of clients. And the reason it's grown like that is because it has performed really well. So I asked Nick, as I did last night with Gerry Faurie of Capitec, and incidentally, Capitec itself went to a new high today, up 2.5%. But I asked Nick Belkin, the Chief Investment Officer at Ford, what his secret sauce is.
Consultants want you to define yourself, and therefore it's easy to say value or growth or whatever, because it becomes easy, you know, just to communicate with people like you and just the market. But at the end of the day, there are many ways to make money. And as soon as you box yourself into one of those, you end up effectively closing the door to the other side of it. So I think Dave's used the word imperial pragmatists. To be honest, I think it's just really, you know, just really look after the investment. Make sure that what you're looking at, you've thought about, you've analyzed, you actually are long-term in your thinking. You understand where the management are going, and you have a forecast and a forward-looking version of where the earnings are going to go, and then pay the right price. Now, sometimes if if there is a 15 to 20 PE stock, it better grow with certainty for very long to unwind that. But sometimes you've got a lower PE, and then the valuation is your opportunity. I think to close the door to any one of those opportunities is wrong. At the end of the day, we're trying to price a free cash flow for our investor, and sometimes it's a cheap free cash flow that grows slowly, and sometimes it's a higher rated free cash flow that grows faster. I think at the end of the day, you're trying to understand the sustainability of those cash flows. And I think that's where the balance, because you're trying to balance the price you pay with the value you're getting. And sometimes it's just too high for the value you're getting. And, you know, it's that kind of happy tension that I think we as investors are trying to get at, and not just box yourself into one or the other.
Just explain that, cash flows.
Yeah, so at the end of the day, whether you're investing in a bond, and remember, we've got lots of multi-asset funds also where you effectively play off an equity versus a bond and cash and property. Each one of those, if you have an example of a property giving you a 10% yield, you know, that is a effectively their free cash flow of the property company. In an industrial company, sometimes you have a cash flow that you generate from the operations, but then you have to spend on capital equipment. You spend on expansionary capital equipment. Is it going to be paying off or not? And then at the end of, you know, after the cash that comes in, the cash that goes out, that is effectively a cash yield that you can earn on the investment. And then you can try and understand what kind of required return you want for given that risk that I spoke about earlier.
It's lovely talking to these guys who really know their business, the fund managers. And, I think we're going to be hearing a lot more from Nick Belkin on this program going into the future. Just to close off, wrapping up with the markets as a whole, I did mention earlier that the Rand was under a little bit of pressure, but 1740 is still a long way from where it was ahead of the Government of National Unity. The platinum shares keep getting stronger. Resources shares also ticking upwards. So what that's telling you is, although things in the Middle East are worrying, the market as a whole, and that the market is not some nefarious beings who are directing the future for the rest of us. It is a conglomeration, an accumulation of ideas of everybody who's investing, and they're investing mostly their own money or the money of their institutions that they represent. So they don't want to make a mistake. So it's like this combination of ideas, which is a far, far better indicator of reality than when you get people who sit in ivory towers trying to apply the law or the rules or what they think is best for the rest of us. That's why we believe at BizNews that the markets really do know best, because it is this accumulation of the best ideas of everybody in the world. And what the markets are telling us is that, yes, it's serious in the Middle East, but the world isn't in a bad place. China is starting to re-stimulate. Interest rates are falling around the world. Economic growth is likely to go up a little in the future. And as a consequence of this, share markets are improving. It helps in South Africa because we are really very reliant on what occurs in the global economy. This country has roughly 50% of its GDP, 50% of the money that is spent in a year is either through imports or exports. We are what is called an open economy and very vulnerable to the waves of global progress or recess. And at the moment, we're seeing the resources shares improving on the anticipation that resources prices, commodity prices, on which our country still relies so heavily, will be improving as demand improves because the global economy improves. Well, I hope that that all makes sense to you. Thank you for being with me again today. We will be back again. Remember the timing for the Biz News Briefing, 5 o'clock for the audio-only version, 6 o'clock for video, which is on Biz News TV. Until the next time, cheerio.